Hi everyone, welcome and thanks for joining us. I am Vivek and I'm with the consumer team at Z47. And joining with me today is Chandrasekhar and Akash, investors on the consumer team. And today we'll be spending time talking about how India is approaching the app economy 3.0. Before we really get into it, let me start with a couple of assertions. India as a country leapfrogged when it came to smartphones. We started out back in 2014, if I just go back a decade, it used to be about not more than 100 odd million smartphone users. And now we are seeing it sitting more than 600 million connected smartphone users. In terms of transacting users, we are already at about 150 million transacting users as on FY23. And the context is it used to be just about 4 million back as 2015. Now we have large profitable businesses existing in this space who are building viable businesses and serving millions of customers. India has really taken its stead as the primary download market in the app economy, but the reality now that is shifting is that it is now doing much more and going deeper into the engagement funnel. So, Kash, let me start with you. As we're really starting out in this thesis and thinking about the broader app economy, maybe just walk us through how the overall app economy in India played out over the past decade and how did it really unfold?
Yeah, so I would start with potentially not just India, and I would say that in 2009 is roughly when the App Store got launched, right? And that's the big bang moment of app economy. And if you look at it, forever we have been talking about three stages of how the maturity happens in an app market, right? Even if you look at how this has played out globally, 1.0 was predominantly about downloads, engagement, eyeballs, and ad-led monetization being center stage, right? The first version of non-ad-led monetization that you saw was primarily, you know, we moved from the mindset of boxed software coming into pricing it on the App Store, right? You used to see these premium apps, which would be $1, $4, $10, whatever, right? But single ticket price. Cut to 2.0, where I would say is the phase where across the world of software and even in apps, we started getting to a point where we saw the birth and then the very rapid evolution of monetizing users as they go or in a subscription manner. And that's when the real transaction model started emerging, right? On the other end, software also went through the same thing. Right? Software went through its own transition on cloud. Now, those models actually in the app economy got further deepened than it happened in general software. I would say the biggest innovation that we discovered in the app economy was that gaming led the course, and they pretty much came and figured out that, oh, we can design these in-app economies. So in-app purchases need not be restricted to just small intangible goods and not just utilities. People can now actually pay, and we started seeing a very different behavior where transactions took a equally important center stage, and you saw a behavior emerge of what we like to call in gaming power users, right? No longer was it dependent on CV, Akash, and Vivek are going to spend the same amount of money in the app. Each one could spend very differently, right? Freemium models emerged, right? Freemium pretty much emerged from the fact that you could have a smaller base, which could be transacting, but you could they might transact disproportionately. And we went through 1.0, 2.0, and when we cut back to 3.0, right? I think 3.0 is predominantly where you see both the eyeball-led models and the transaction-led models play out to their fullest. And it manifests in multiple ways where you would see, you know, I'll go back to gaming where people used to say, are you monetizing in-app or are you monetizing through ads? And today that's not even a question, right? It is a hybrid monetization. Because at the end, what you're trying to do is you have this app, which is hopefully retentive, and you've got users engaged. You are trying to monetize that engagement. Can you monetize that engagement through a transaction-led model? Yes. Can you monetize that engagement through an ad-led model? Yes. Why would you want to choose? And I think that's the core of what has played out in 3.0. It's playing out in 3.0. And India is unlocking that opportunity to its fullest.
Got it. And CV, as somebody who has been on the ringside, as these consumer businesses grew, as an operator and now as an investor, how is your view of this market and what do you see?
First of all, thanks a lot for having me on the pod. It's great to be back. It's a topic that's very close to my heart and I'm very excited to share what we're finding as well. So I'll approach 3.0 from a different angle from what Akash mentioned, and I completely agree to where he's coming from, but here's the other way to look at it. So globally, we've always been known, India is this DAO MAO farm in some form, right? Just users who don't pay in some form. That led to the assumption that ads are potentially the only way that you can monetize. People said ad market's growing. Now we're saying it's a $15 billion India ad market, out of which $7.5 billion is digital. But if you look below the surface, 70% of that is going back to Google and Meta. And I would argue for the rest, 30%, a very large part of it is being captured by Amazon, Flipkart, and the commerce-led ad models of the world, right? And hence, ads has taken time to mature. It's still exciting, but it is taking time to mature. Then we took another step back and said, you know what? Can we just directly convert social behavior into commerce? Which is when we started experimenting with video commerce, live commerce, and all those components. I would argue we are still some way off from that being a large business. It's inevitable, but we'll have to go through our own journey to unlock that. But the third part, which I find very positive, and the reason why I guess we are having this pod as well, is India has started to pay for digital content and digital services. And that's fantastic news, right? India's finally ready to pay for stuff that we assumed India would always want for free. And I think that's the part that I'm most excited about. The way to look at it is now we not just have an ads market, but we also have a transactions market to monetize. And in some form, I think the belief here internally as well is that you will always have a mix of both, but you should have both. And you should have a clear way to tap into both profit pools.
Taking a step back on the transactions market overall, if you really look at the way in which many of these consumer apps are monetizing and building a business model out of it, we really see three broad buckets of activity in terms of transacting users, right? You see applications going after subscriptions, which has been quite common in SaaS as well. And there were prosumer applications which came out, which were primarily grown through this. This is primarily your productivity and utility apps. Then you had the in-app advertising-led models, primarily dominant in the early social and the early gaming apps. And then we are talking about the in-app purchases, which is really focused on virtual digital goods. Now, I think the core idea of being able to build a transaction-led business is that you can almost build a continuous monetization curve, right? You are not waiting for billing from a user for a value that is delivered at the end of a month. What you're really doing is monetizing them almost on a real-time basis. So the value realization is almost immediate. So given this context, what are the neighborhoods where we are seeing company creation happening from entrepreneurs who are pursuing this thesis? And what have you started seeing here?
I think there's a lot of interesting things are happening and broadly four areas of interest. But before I get into that, I also want to take cues from what's happening globally, right? We've all seen what's happened in Himalaya with China. But if you also look at what's happening with Reelshot in the US, I think that's actually exemplary on how this thing could play out. This is what looks like currently a $200 million ARR sort of business. They do episodic content, but each episode is about a minute long, right? 80 episodes to an entire series. So they come in, they shoot the entire series together in about $300K US dollars, and then they put it out in cuts. Now, each minute of those episodes has a start, a plot, a climax, a hook that makes you want to scroll up and watch the next episode. It's interesting how they monetize it. While they do have a subscription element, they also have a pay-per-episode sort of element. So typically takes about $10 to $20 to watch an entire series, right? What's the advantage here? The advantage here is you can capture true consumer surplus. For somebody who's engrossed in the drama and wants to finish that storyline, this is literally saying, I will only take money from the people who want to watch that, but from them I will take $20. From the others, I will take zero. They'll find something else to watch on, right? I think that's the beauty of what we are internally terming as microtransactions. And that's what it allows us to unlock, right? Now, coming back to the four broad areas that are interesting. If you take cues on formats, the way that we're thinking about this, there are four broad areas. Number one is areas around financial expectations. This is your RMG, prediction markets, Dream11, Zoopy. We've seen all these companies and fantastic large companies that are creating value. I think it's more or less understood. So let me quickly jump to the other three. One of them is content. And so far, I think we look at content and think OTT. But going back to my real short example, now you could actually relook at content to say, what else could content be packaged as? Is there a smaller format? Is there an audio format? Can you teach people? Can you entertain people? Can you give them what they want in their verticalized niche in some form, right? And that I think is really exciting, especially when you move away from, as you mentioned, subscriptions to transactions and microtransactions. The third part is access and free to play. And it's a broadish definition, but it's basically saying you can access basic stuff for free, but post that, I'm going to charge you for additional. This is your free-to-play games come here, all your freemium models come here. I'd argue a lot of matchmaking apps also come here, where you want to get more matches, you top up, etc. Right? It's an interesting space as well. Again, capturing the same consumer surplus thematic that we had. And the fourth one, and very interestingly, is the whole peer-to-peer, what we call P2P and B2C digital services, right? And this is everything from AstroTalk, what you're seeing with Srimandir, apps where you are able to pay another person / business for digital content and digital services, which I would argue would have been very difficult to build without the UPI rails, without, you know, auto renewals being easy, which would have been difficult to pay without trust being there in the ecosystem. And I think that's the large part when we were discussing as well, to say trust itself is unlocked, where people are ready to say, you know, I'm not getting duped here. I am ready to pay for the value that's accruing to me.
I think, CV, you articulated the four broader buckets where we see company creation activity, and seems to be the case that they're all broadly threaded by the same type of monetization and consumer demand tapping that these entrepreneurs are trying to do. I think, Akash, what would be interesting is for us to really walk through the nuances of these businesses, right? Because fundamentally, if you look below the surface, they all seem to be catering to completely different audience. And the operational machinery that needs to be in place to make them work seems to be very different. What are the various areas that one should be cognizant of?
See, that can be an exhaustive list, a pretty wide list, right? I would rather break it down in terms of principles that matter in some way. The topmost of that would be, what is the nature, and CV spoke about P2B, P2B, what is the core nature of the economic value exchange, right? That would also govern what all do you need to put in place, either in form of trust or in form of seamlessness of the transaction flow. And I'll pick on that nuance in some way, which is, earlier in subscription businesses, it used to be hard in India to make those because you did not have the auto renew rails at your disposal. You could only do it with credit cards were underpenetrated. Obviously, credit cards themselves have gone up in penetration in the country. But UPI autopay was a massive unlock, because if you talk to anyone who would have spent time building in subscription, they would tell you, for the same engaged user, same behavior, the renewal rate goes up by 2x if you have an autopay instrument, right? Now, if you double click further on that nuance, some people can also tend to misuse it, right? Like if you go back to reviews, which you'll see on these apps globally, one big qualm people have with them is they can't even cancel their subscription, they get charged, right? So I would say the nuances which matter if you're building something of this nature would be, how well are you using those autopay rails? But at the same time, are you continuously not losing trust or building distrust with your end users because you are ending up charging the ones for whom it doesn't work, right? So again, the vector there is trust. Trust is key. You need to maintain that. So that's one nuance if you're doing a subscription business. Another nuance of around trust would be if you're doing a P2P business, right? It almost goes back to early days of commerce where we had eBay and Amazon and big debate. At one point of time, eBay was touted to be the biggest marketplace ever, and it did not end up becoming that because C2C was hard. To solve for that I would not get duped was a hard problem to solve. Can you solve that? So if you're doing P2P, P2B might be an easier one, P2P would be harder because you have lesser control. If you're a platform, you have lesser control on what that exchange and transaction would be. So let's say if you're building a P2B service around, I don't know, companionship, right? You have far little control. You have little control. You don't have zero control. Right. So as a platform, your job becomes, what control mechanisms can you put in place? Can you ensure that if it's a matchmaking platform, the experience for either a female or a male on the other side is not something that they would not want, right? It is not something which is off-putting. It is not something where they are scammed in any way, right? And we already see examples of these when we interact with founders and companies who are building in this, that there is a decent amount of this error rate, slippage rate, which is there in the interactions. Now, if you don't control it and if you do not solve for these, you would eventually build a platform which loses users, right? So I would say trust, quality of service, the same two principles which matter if you're building anything, any product or service.
I think we should also spend some time on especially content generation and the cost associated with that. You've worked in Hotstar as well, and I'm sure you've seen that journey of what quality content means and how easy it is to create some of these quality content. So what's your point of view on that? There's a nuance there as well that I feel a lot of people ignore on innovation on that piece.
So I would say around content, right? And I think you can almost tie it back to attention, right? One big shift in the app economy world is also that there are multiple apps and everyone's competing for attention. And when you're competing for attention, the bar on what you need to deliver in terms of a content experience, be it gaming, be it video, be it audio, be it graphic novels, any form factor, right? The consumer has an option. They can hit up someone else. And hence, the bar to continuously deliver quality content-led interaction is very high. Like if I had to tell you how high it is and where it is now becoming a challenge also to some extent, and also a vector for innovation, and we'll cover both. The challenge is, if you think of the world of broadcast, it was very simple. 24 hours in a day, 4 hours of prime time, 4 hours of programming, 5 days a week, 52 weeks. That's the amount of content you need to do. Cut to today where we are, where every user has now gotten used to expecting high velocity, high quality, fresh content every time they open up the app, right? And that aspect of the shifting consumer behavior that came with the app economy, right, has led to both a challenge and a vector for innovation emerging, which is the cost of content is a key vector, right? It's a key part of how you build the business. Whether you call it cost of content, whether you call it cost of service, you really need to have a high degree of control on that. And when I say degree of control, you really need to almost figure out innovative ways continuously to keep bringing it down. And I'll take a simple example. If you're building a video platform, you are competing for attention with Insta Reels, YouTube, all the OTT apps, everyone under the sun. The consumer's perception, and you know, there used to be this thing which we hear from a lot of media professionals, used to be YouTube content is not professional. That's not how the consumer behaves, right? The perception of quality is not in isolation. It is not just about the production or how the video looks. The personalization is a big part of the quality there, right? The consumer sticks to that. That works for them. So you can't take a shortcut to this. The bar is very high. And hence, you still see people in the video, premium video space, being forced to churn out large volumes of content, meet the high production bar, and keep going at it. Whereas if you take audio platform examples, I would say the biggest leverage that they unlocked was that the cost of making the content was drastically low. So if you were to think of a P&L and you were to say, like, what's the cost of revenue? The cost of revenue for them was extremely low. And hence the leverage that they got in terms of being able to churn and produce far more content, go for those machine-like method of finding hits, was very different. They used it to their advantage. And that is where you have companies like Pocket FM today, right? Who are unlocking a completely different P&L, which looks way more lucrative than what I would have seen in the past with a video service, right? So I would say content, to your question, is potentially the biggest thing to solve for. So if a founder is building a platform,
I think across models, the one difference is compared to the Netflix/Spotify age, where high quality was available and then you're sort of making it accessible and building the rails for that. We're seeing in the 3.0 a lot of new kinds of supply, new kinds of content being generated. And in some form, that has to be your first moat, right? What's the unique way by which you are unlocking cost / speed / uniqueness in what you're able to provide? And that's true not just for, like you said, content, but it might be, can you get great quality supply of astrologists and build a moat around that to say, this is where you come for the right expert. And that's the most fun part, I feel, because you sort of have to try multiple things and figure out, oh, yahan pe nahi hai. Audio business is different from video. The costs are significantly lower. And that's the part where I feel a founder should and is spending most of his or her time, primarily because it's not like India's reached a place where you'll pay hundreds of dollars, right? The depth isn't there yet. So you got to build a business where the content cost allows for you to create enough of a cross margin, CM, whatever you call it, so that your business actually gets built and you do have enough money left for marketing and CAC and all of that. And that it's an interesting part. It's also, I think, the most exciting part of building something like this is that you're creating something from scratch and reimagining how the cost on that could be much lower than what it is.
I think this is also probably the reason why we get so excited about user-generated content, because that's a fundamentally different way of approaching the content supply problem. And instead of trying to do all of that yourself, you almost try to create a marketplace and enable more creators to come in and hence lift the overall supply of content. I think we talked about the complexities of these businesses in depth, and we see hundreds of these businesses in on a regular basis. And it's almost been a Cambrian explosion in terms of company creation across all the segments that we talked about. When we evaluate these businesses as an early stage investment firm and as people who have a deep perspective on the space, what are the key areas where we try to get smarter on? And what are the specific nuances of looking at the data of how the business is performing that helps us underwrite the risk? If you could walk through that, I think that will be really beneficial to folks who would be listening in.
So Vivek, on this one, I would say all of us should talk through it, and I'll talk through at least the one like which I hold almost sacrosanct, which is retention makes or breaks a business. The first question I want to think through, we engage with founders in a similar way, is if you were to acquire 100% of your market today, 5 years from now, how much money would you be making, right? And that is hinged on retention. So one thing I would expect out of builders would be a very, very high degree of obsession around retention. And the reason that matters is, as I said, that it's an attention economy and also in some way. And to do things in the product or around your service which gets you to a point of being a highly retentive product, the precursor to that is shaping a sticky behavior, sticky habit-forming behavior. And the fundamental foundation of getting to that is mimicking natural frequency. So for me, these three things matter. And if I have to go upwards from, like go bottom up, natural frequency, what does it mean? Oh, if I'm building a video product, let's be super clear. Every user has a natural behavior of how they engage with content. The natural behavior in which a typical consumer engages with content is roughly 4 to 6 hours in a week over 2 to 3 days. That's the natural behavior of a normal user. If your platform is not hitting a natural frequency which is in sync with this natural behavior, right, you will potentially not have a path to build a sticky habit and hence a retentive product, right? So you need to start from some sort of a X, A, Y, B sort of a framework for yourself, where you're trying to say, what is the behavior that a user has? And can I replicate that behavior on my platform? If you look at even Sri Mandir for that matter, Apps for Bharat, I think Prashant as a founder over there did a great job from the day zero, being super clear about, first, I want to solve for the natural behavior and get to that natural frequency of the product. People who are devoted and who follow it or practice something, they almost have a near daily behavior around it. And unless and until I'm building a platform around that, I will not have a sticky product, right? And unlike a lot of the predecessors who would have come before Sri Mandir, who would have tried to do e-puja or e-darshan and something, even though they were also building transaction models. I would reckon that for Sri Mandir, first focusing on nailing the natural behavior and frequency and then unlocking transactions is potentially going to be a reason why they succeed, right? So natural frequency, natural behavior, retention metric is the other thing. Again, as obsessed about retention, people tend to think of retention as a vanity. Oh, my day 30 is this much, my day 7 is this much, my day 90 is this much. Yes, those are the outputs, right? But from a building lens, when you're building a platform, you need to know what the retention metric is, right? And the retention metric is super sharp. So let's say, and I'll take an example from maybe SaaS, Zoom, almost SaaS, consumer product, whatever you want to call it. For Zoom, the retention metric is 4-star plus rated weekly active hosts. And this is key, right? They don't think of the product as just daily activity or this. They're super sharp in saying 4-star plus rated weekly active hosts. How many hostings did you do which were 4-star plus and in a week? Because that is what they are mapping back to. They're saying weekly is the behavior, hosting is the key retention metric. If a user is hosting and they're giving me a 4-star plus quality rating on that, I have a sticky product. So identifying your retention metric is super key. And I think that's where almost majority of the ecosystem tends to lose and miss the forest for the trees.
And I think this is where a lot of founders end up making a mistake of trying to find an absolute retention benchmark, trying to index your business against...
Your retention benchmark needs to be fully your own. It is very particular, or it's very custom to the nature of business you are in, what you are doing, how your product is taking shape. It's almost like saying in retention and growth, we say, you can only nurture something which is natural, right? As a builder, your job is to nurture that natural behavior. It is going to be very unique to your product.
I think that's the part that's underappreciated as well. I think there are a lot of these benchmarks floating around to say, meet this number, meet that number, meet your day 7 versus day 30. But the businesses are fundamentally very different. Like, easier to explain in consumer landscape, you're not going to compare Lifebuoy usage to Nike purchase, right? It's just completely different. And some of these businesses are very different, look very different, their social graphs are different. And I would actually argue for a consumer surplus business where it's microtransactions and you're trying to get the top Pareto. Is the large retention number the metric you want to go for, or is the power user amount they pay, the LTV, what you want to go for? So maybe you want to touch that point as well on what that looks like.
No, and that is very important. So, and if we have to talk absolutes, I would say, oh, absolute number, great consumer product should at least be, the best ones are golden ratio, 66. If not, then you should be 40-50% plus asymptotic flatline retention. But is that the absolute way to look at these businesses? Not at all. Because if you take learnings from the gaming world, even if I have an asymptote at 9, 14, 15%, because I'm solving for getting this insanely highly engaged user, and because my monetization ability is not limited by how much time the user is spending on the platform, the same user, it's the same game, both of us could be that retained cohort, I could still spend $1,000, right? And CV could only be spending $10, $20 a month on the game. That's the beauty of those businesses,
yep,
right? And I think that's the other piece, right? And again, to your point that there is no single absolute benchmark. There are some guidance principles that, yes, typically if you are building a power user-based business where you can keep transacting and getting far more average revenue from a smallish cohort, you at least still need to be in the 10-15 zone,
right?
If you are a more core user behavior product where it's the baseline is going to be slightly normalized in terms of monetization, you would at least want to be 25-40%. If you are a very light user product, wherein your monetization is extremely flatline, right? And I would put subscription there. It's purely flatline. I would say there, nothing short of an M12 of 55-60%. Because again, the original question, driving user acquisition growth is very easy in these businesses. It can come at a cost, You can be more efficient or less efficient about it, but you can get it. But you will run out of the market, right? So the simple question is, even if you get 100% of the market today, how much will you be making 5 years from now?
I think that's where a lot of nuances get lost out. When you think about ARPU of these businesses in general, when you talk about subscriptions and the way that you describe it, it almost feels like you are extracting the same value from the user. But what ends up happening in this media and content platforms is consumption is disproportionate. The value that a user extracts from these platforms is also disproportionate. So if you have a mechanism that can derive disproportionate value from these customers, I think that is when you're likely to build that 10,000, 20,000 super fans who you can really build a business off of the back of.
So let me throw that back to you. You had done some benchmarking on at least gaming, right? So what's the Pareto there like? Like how stark can, like we're saying, 10% or 5%, how stark can it get in your view?
I think the numbers itself would be surprising and shocking to a lot of extent for if you look at it from an outside perspective. Conversion rates in most of these industries could be as low as 1.5 to 2%. And in many cases, it could be even lower. Even within that 1% of conversion, you see almost 80% of users really contributing to only about 20% of the revenue. And the rest of the revenue is what comes from what we in our parlance call whales. And a focus of a lot of these consumer apps that emerged from Europe and the West in the early days were to orient their entire organization to finding and nurturing these whales and ensuring that they have the journey through the natural usage frequency being retaining, and then stacking these cohorts really ended up being the primary priority. So the Pareto on this one is just extreme, and the more the extreme the Pareto is, the more your product has to be geared towards those power users. You cannot have an experience that caters only to the normal or the median user. It needs something that can satisfy the power user as well. I think CV, just on that note, right? There is so much of these complexities that a founder really has to sort of think through. The market landscape is quickly shifting. And as Akash mentioned, acquisition was not a problem in the past. What are the things that somebody who's starting out new right now in 2024 should keep in mind to make this happen?
A couple of learnings for myself, and it's changed the way that I've been looking at the landscape as well. I think in 3.0, if you had to take away one message from the entire piece, is monetize early. Do not wait for you to hit a certain number of users at a certain scale. Do not be tentative on should I put a payment page or not. Put it up front. See if they will pay. See how high they will go. See how low they will go. And run all these experiments super early. The answer earlier used to be get a meaningful amount of number of customers and then see, run experiments to see. But in 3.0, if the users are ready to pay for some of these services, you might actually be better off flywheeling the business on actual revenue. And that's my one biggest takeaway. Apart from that, I think two, three points that I would think about. One is there is a tendency to build a horizontal use case. And I would actually shy away from that and say, I would say start as niche as you can go, right? If you can double click on a genre, if you can double click on a certain TG in a certain language to find your PMF and how you can monetize those users, I would actually start there. Rather than being a horizontal, this is kind of for everybody, here's 100 pieces of content that I will mathematically say 5 segments, 20 programs each so that they will find something to watch. I think that's the wrong way to do it. It also hits your CAC negatively. So you want to be as sharp as possible, and then users will also always allow you to broaden that piece. Amazon started selling books, right? I think that approach still holds. The third part, and we've hit on it, but I think it's still important, is what is your undue advantage on cost or CAC? And on this one, my suspicion is a lot of your undue advantage might be on cost, at least in the beginning, while you figure out how to really make that service P&L-wise sustainable, right? And I'd spend a lot more time there. And the fourth one is, I think, a mishmash of part of what Akash already articulated, to say, when you look at metrics, like force yourself to be both numerate about the metrics in terms of measuring everything, but also be really, really honest to yourself to say, you know, how big is this power user cohort? And how big is this TAM really going to get? A lot of times you kind of say, okay, these many X number of users in this TG, and hence X into Y is equal to, and because X is a very large number given India's population, always comes out to, dekho, here is my $500 million TAM. That might not be true. So for the business that you're building, see what the actual power user cohort could look like, measure that retention number very carefully and model your paybacks accordingly. And this has implications. The answer might still be build that business. But then the question on do you raise capital, when do you want to raise capital, do you need capital at all, might change. You might just say, you know what, I don't need millions of dollars to build this. I can build this business on this niche user, which will generate positive cash flows, right? So I think those are the nuances I'd want founders to be a little more honest about. But that being said, I think there are truly massive businesses to be built, provided you sort of hit these 3-4 points.
And that monetization early, I would stress more on is, it's almost your path to PMF, right? We spoke about cost, we spoke about retention, we spoke about natural behavior, nurturing that natural behavior, getting the right retention metric. It's very unique to every business. There is no one single benchmark. If you piece all of those things together, the equation effectively is, we're saying that, oh, gaming can be good even with 8, 9, 10% because you have that monetization and economic PMF,
yeah.
Right? So the monetization early is almost now, I would say, for us as a group, a non-starter. Like if you're not doing it, there is no clarity about PMF, right? People used to earlier in the world of, and again, that's a 1 to 2 to 3 transition. In the world of 1.0, it used to be get the eyeballs and then we'll figure out life, right? I don't think 3.0 is like that. 3.0 is economic PMF is the only PMF and you need to be obsessed about it.
Yeah. I think nailing the payback really is the key takeaway over here. And I think once you reach the stage where your cohorts start paying back, you as a business start being able to scale on your own merit. And the capital dependency also reduces. So overall, a good thing to really pursue. I think that's fantastic. And given the context of how App Economy 3.0 is progressing, what are some of the top trend lines that you guys are excited about? And maybe I can go first.
You should go first.
Talk about some of the reasons why we really feel there is still so much more to be done. And one area in the thesis that we really like is the broader loneliness thesis. We are a young country. 1/3 of our population is currently Gen Z. And there is a real crisis in people being able to find somebody to be with from a relationship perspective, from a companionship perspective. It's an increasingly lonely society, and historically dating matrimonial websites and apps have tried to fill in that gap, but for various reasons they haven't been able to solve that. But with what is changing right now in terms of what's possible with technology, I think that really gets unlocked. And
a good answer to that is more pubs also, but that's okay.
Yeah. But I think a lot more apps, you might be seeing a lot more chatbots, a lot more companions. And if you look at applications like Replica, you could almost have your best friend living in your phone. And while it's dystopian to an extent, I think that just talks about how we are heading as a society and there's companies to be built there.
Spend on religion is what? Between 2 to 3% of our GDP, right? And that's massive. So we typically immediately go down to Bollywood and cricket and we sort of think those are the only verticals that are deep enough. And I think there are a lot more. Interesting apps like Stage are building for the vernacular audience, right? So I think that the market in India is deepening. I'm really excited by, can companies articulate what's unique to India? What are the verticals that are unique to India? And then build for that in a meaningful, sustainable fashion. I feel the CAC journey will be easier on some of these because at least they're super sharp and saying, this is the one use case I'm building for. And that extends to, like you said, loneliness. But I'd also say companionship is a problem that needs to be solved, not just for the young and the Gen Z. It could also happen for your senior citizens. Yeah. Right. So I'd actually split that. And if you can articulate a problem that is strong enough of an issue and you have the right economic PMF around it, I think those are really exciting problems to solve for.
Akash?
Yeah, listening to you guys, I would just say I will not pick one, I'll pick two. I'll be greedy. I think in continuation of the theme of audiences and customer backwards, I would say a beauty about India and which I'm very bullish will play out soon is that it's not just senior, Gen Z, language. Like these are your usual dimensions of looking at cohorts, right? If I was to ask you how many bikers are there in this country or how many runners are there in this country, like people who relate to that, I don't know, tribal behavior, whatever you want to call it. And I think those are also going to be very big opportunities. So if you'd have to think from an audience backward lens, I would say you can find multiple niches. The beauty of having 1 billion plus people, 600 million plus connected, and what now almost 400 million plus transacting for digital goods, is that you pick a good cohort, build a highly retentive product, pick language, tribe, whatever, you have a business, right? On the thematic of App 3.0, besides that, I would say fan-controlled media is something that I am super excited about. So again, similar neighborhood, fan-controlled media, hyper-personalized content. And I think for me, that is more to do with the fact that it has always been the holy grail. I think today it is executable. Today it is doable. With the advent of everything that has been happening around tooling or the core foundational tech, which allows you to build scaffolding on top and get to that outcome, I think it's real, it's here, and potentially going to be one of the largest businesses that we'll see emerge.
I think we've done a good job of not saying AI, like...
We managed to not say AI now.
But I think we should spend some time on that piece as well. It is the largest sort of technological wave that's hitting us. So I think my question for the both of you here is, what's that impact going to look like? It's way more, will AI hit a bar of soap first or a piece of content first? It'll hit the piece of content first, right? It's not going to hit the bar of soap. So it's front and center to everything happening on media, social, gaming. Maybe you should spend a couple of minutes on that as well.
Thank you for bringing AI again, once more. I would say AI impact and truly is going to be on content, right? For a single reason, even if you look at what we have been doing around advances in AI, it has mostly been around modality transfer, right? We break it up into saying text to audio, text to video, image to video, text to image, whatever. It's all about content, right? And if you really draw this curve out and forward, you would, and even if you trace it backwards, you would see that cost of production of content has always been on the down curve, except for maybe the cost you have to incur on people. If you think of large TV shows or movies today, they are massively produced in virtual production environments. People have always been trying to bring down costs. The only cost which has been bloating up over there has been the cost of talent, right? I think that trend line will just continue. Cost of production will keep going down. It will almost go down to near zero. It will always trend towards zero. And I would say that's the opportunity. The opportunity is, if we are saying it's an attention economy, and we are saying one of the biggest challenges, and earlier in the discussion we covered it, is cost of content, content production, velocity of producing content, being fresh with content, solving for what I said, fan-controlled, hyper-personalized. If these are the things, a lot of these things become really, truly possible because cost of production is going to zero. If cost of production is going to near zero, you have insane leverage.
Yeah.
I'm excited about founders who are really going to play with this sandbox they're being given now, saying, oh, to build an attention economy and app economy, you can now play around with near zero cost of production and insane fungibility in terms of what you can do with an idea, an IP, and how you can modify it, transform it, tweak it. There is so much that can be done. It is just going to be a function of great founders coming up and innovating on top of it.
I think what I always like to say is all technological innovation that consumers see is downstream of attention economy applications. And that has been true for porn, gaming. If you really take it down that route, I am pretty sure this is the frontier where innovation will happen and where AI will be democratized and reach consumer scale. It is likely already happening with OpenAI and the Copilot productivity apps. It will play out through these companion apps and then more use cases will emerge. So clearly what this points to is almost a Cambrian explosion of new companies that will be created and hopefully more passionate entrepreneurs who are chasing this opportunity. And as a team, we are extremely excited to meet more of those people. And if you're building in the space, thinking about ideas, do reach out to us, send us a note. Would love to have a cup of coffee and discuss ideas. But thank you so much. This has been fantastic on joining us on this edition and look forward to being here back soon.
Thank you.
Thank you.